Good evening, everybody. So nice to see you all on a Monday night to learn some Torah with you. I hope it will be a really inspirational gathering tonight. Welcome back to Elevating the Sparks. Elevating the Sparks. Wow, it's been a day. Elevating the Sparks. We've been learning about the teachings of Chassidus together, a little bit of the history of the Baal Shem Tov and his followers and some of their teachings. I know many people reached out to me to tell me how much they enjoyed last week's session with Chazon Freund, where he shared some of his experiences with being a Lubavitcher Chassid. I found it to be very inspirational as well, and I forwarded those wishes. And today we move on. Today we move on to a very unique thinker in his own right, really, and that's understating it. And that is Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. Hopefully you've heard of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, an incredible tzaddik and thinker, an extraordinary life, not necessarily in the happiest way. And we're going to learn about him today, some about his life, some of his teachings, and maybe I'm hoping next week I did reach out to someone who works for the Breslov Institute. And I'm hoping maybe he'll agree to share some of his thoughts and experiences with us next week, please God. We'll have to see. Okay, so let's talk a little bit. I do need to give a brief proviso before I begin tonight, which applies to all of the different tzaddikim and rebbes we've learned about, but particularly tonight. And that is that none of these sessions are meant to be exhaustive, or this is not a PhD dissertation on any specific Rebbe or Chassidus. I am certainly no expert. My goal is to simply share with you a taste of all the different tzaddikim, and hopefully we can gain from them, and hopefully it's inspirational, and hopefully you're encouraged to learn more. And I think that applies in particular tonight, because Rabbi Nachman of Breslov is an absolutely incomparable thinker. I'll get to the title of the shir tonight. I entitled this shir, Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, the deepest and simplest of Jews. And I'll talk about why I entitled the shir in that way. But Rabbi Nachman's Torah is so deep and so expansive. His student, Rabbi Nassan of Nemirov, Rabbi Nathan Steinhardt, wrote so much wisdom. And you could literally spend your entire life reading about the Torah of Nachman. And I am not exaggerating. There are people that do. There are people that devote all of their time to learning Rabbi Nachman's Torah, whether it's the Likutei Moharan, which is his magnum opus, whether it's all the stories that Rabbi Nachman wrote. He was an incredibly prolific author and a very creative writer. Whether it's the stories about Rabbi Nachman, and if you've seen Reza Chassidim, they have all sorts of pamphlets that they're constantly giving out or Nachman's ideas. It is impossible to encompass Rabbi Nachman even in a course dedicated to the study of his Torah, let alone in a session. So please don't get any sort of misconception to think that after tonight's class, you will have encapsulated everything Rabbi Nachman has to offer. I'm not capable of giving you that. But I do hope that you'll get a taste that draws you to Rabbi Nachman's Torah. And let me say the following. I, in my studies, always was apprehensive about approaching Rabbi Nachman's Torah. I don't know if any of you know any Breslov or Hasidim or heard about Breslov. It's very intense. It's very intense. And maybe you've heard about the gatherings at Uman that happen every Rosh Hashanah. There's a lot there, and I found it to be a bit too much for me at times. I will confess that is so. And so I was apprehensive. But if you get a taster of Nachman's Torah, you see how, on the one hand, how much he has his finger on the pulse of the struggles of simply trying to serve God in the world, and how much he understands the struggle of the common Jew, and how insightful his advice is on the one hand, and also at the same time, how profound of a thinker he was. So with that introduction, and I hope I didn't bore you, let's dive in a little bit to Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. I'm going to share my screen with you, and we will begin. Here we go. Okay. This is going to be, looks like you're still loading. One second, please. Wow, that took a long time. It's never taken that long before. But Rabbi Nachman always tells us never to give up hope. So we're here. We made it. Okay, let's learn a little bit about Rabbi Nachman's life. Rabbi Nachman of Breslov had an incredibly tragic life. Incredibly tragic. And I know we've talked about many Hasidic rabbis in the last few weeks, and they all seem to have had challenging lives because of the time that they lived in and the opposition to Hasidus. But Rabbi Nachman of Breslov's life, it's painful to even discuss it. Let's start with the very, the math here. He was born in 1772. He passed away in 1810. So think about that for a moment. That's 38 years. He passed away at 38. And think of all he accomplished in those 38 years. Those 38 years were such difficult years. I mean, Nachman was born into Hasidic royalty, as I briefly outlined for you. His great-grandfather was the Baal Shem Tov, whom we discussed at length, the founder of Hasidus, meaning to say his grandmother was the Baal Shem Tov's daughter. And his grandfather was another leading Hasidic grandmaster, a disciple of the Baal Shem Tov, from Nachman of Haradenker. So from both his mother and father's side, he came from a very prestigious Hasidic rabbinic family. And from Nachman, we have, unlike some other Hasidim, we have a lot of biographical information as told by Rav Nachman's students, because there is a litany of stories about Rabbi Nachman written, gathered by his student, Rabbi Nassim, called Shivchei Haran. And by the way, I would like to inspire you to research all of this further, because Safaria, while not a perfect website, is an incredible resource. And Safaria has almost all of the works of Rav Nachman translated into English by the Breslov Institute. So you could look at all the stories of Rav Nachman. And he tells about himself that even at the young age of 6, he was already going to daven by his great-grandfather's grave at night and immersing in the mikvah afterward. At the age of 6, a 6-year-old. Could you imagine that? He was going to the mikvah at 6. And he also writes at length about at a young age, in his early childhood, he already sensed the temptations of the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination of physical temptations in this world. And at the age of 6, he began to live a sort of ascetic lifestyle. And he would fast to control his urges at the age of 6. Understand that. The legend also has it that he, in addition to what his parents would pay his teacher, his Malamed, he would add money from his own savings, whatever he had, to pay his own Malamed as a child. That's how precocious he was in terms of his spiritual sensitivity and his desire to get close to God. And so Rabbi Nachman gets married at 13 years old. Now, I know that was more common in those days, but 13 is pretty young. He gets married at 13 years old to a Sashia and moves to another place in Ukraine to live near his father-in-law. His father-in-law supported him. Unfortunately, soon after he got married, his father-in-law lost his wife, his mother-in-law, and he remarried. And Rabbi Nachman's new mother-in-law did not get along with him. And so she gave him a very difficult time. So soon afterward, he had to move away from his father-in-law, far away, miles away, to another place in Ukraine called Medvedenka. And he set up a rabbinic post there. Another significant milestone in Reb Nachman's life was his mysterious pilgrimage to Israel in 1798, which was around the time Napoleon invaded. And there was a lot of uncertainty as to what would happen with the Jewish communities in Poland and Ukraine. Reb Nachman set out on a pilgrimage to Israel. The legend has it, he traveled for months to get to Israel. Remember, this is the late 1700s. There aren't plane flights. It was an arduous journey. He traveled for months, and legend has it that he took a few steps in Israel, and he concluded, I have gotten all that I needed to receive from this journey. I'm ready to return. So says the legend. A few steps into making it to Israel, he said, the journey, the spiritual process was enough. I can now return. In fact, he actually spent 6 months there. He didn't return right away. But that gives you a hint of the sort of mysterious person he was, always in a spiritual journey. Another significant thing that he did in Israel, it relates to what we learned about 2 weeks ago. If you remember, when we learned about the Baal HaTanya, or Shner Zalman of Liadi, the first Chabad Rebbe, we learned that Chabad Rebbe, or Shner Zalman of Liadi, got into a huge dispute with Rabbi Avraham Kalisker, who was the leader of the Hasidim in Israel at the time. And when Rabbi Nachman went to Israel, one of the things he put effort into doing is to making peace between Rav Shner Zalman of Liadi and Rabbi Avraham Kalisker. And it's with his efforts and those of Rabbi Yitzchak of Berditchev that they ultimately settled, which was a huge important thing for the Hasidus at the time, because it was really tearing the Hasidim into two camps. He returns from Israel, moves to Shpala, which is another place in Ukraine. And there was another rabbi in Shpala at the time, Rabbi Leib of Shpala, also known as Shpala Zeda. It's unclear exactly what happened. Some say that it had to do with a conversation Rabbi Nachman, the Shpala Zeda, had at the time. But again, there was a big dispute. And again, to show you that Hasidus was not short of its own politics. There's always politics. And so the Shpala Zeda was very upset with Rabbi Nachman and the Breslover Hasidim, who weren't Breslover yet, but his followers. And so Rabbi Nachman had to move again. And in 1802, he moves to Breslov. This is why we call Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. He wasn't born in Breslov, but he ultimately moved there after moving from many different places. And that's where he attracts a multitude of Hasidim. The legend has it that Rabbi Nachman saw something in Breslov in Ukraine. He said that in Hebrew, it is composed of the letters Lev Basar, which means a heart of flesh, which is a big part of Rabbi Nachman's teachings. The heart of flesh is from one of the psukim where Hashem says he's going to turn our hearts of stones into hearts of flesh so that we can be sensitive and be moved by inspiration to get close to God. And in Breslov, he meets his student, a very important student I mentioned earlier, Rabbi Nassim of Nemirov. Rabbi Nassim of Nemirov is essentially responsible for all the teachings we have from Rabbi Nachman. Rabbi Nachman did not write his own teachings like many other prolific teachers, but his student in his lifetime wrote down many of his teachings. Rabbi Nachman credited Rabbi Nassim with making sure his Torah was spread. Here's where it gets even darker. Between 1806 and 1807, Rabbi Nachman's family contracted tuberculosis. And at the time, they simply did not have the medicine necessary to deal with it. In those few years, Rabbi Nachman lost an infant son and his wife. They both died of tuberculosis. Ultimately, Rabbi Nachman lost 4 children in infancy, 4 of his, I believe, 8. That's 2, or 4 of his 6, maybe. 2 sons and 2 daughters died in infancy. Imagine his life, right? This is someone who has been running away his entire life, with dispute after dispute, one place to another. He finally settles in Breslov. He finally gets some sort of what you might say menuchas hanefesh, peace, and he loses his wife and four children. In 1808, Rabbi Nassan completes the Likutei Moharan, which is Rabbi Nachman's magnum opus. And then 2 years later, his house burns down. His house burns down in Breslov. Just burns down. And so then Rabbi Nachman moved to Uman. You may have heard of Uman. That is where Rabbi Nachman is buried, and he passed away. Legend has it Rabbi Nachman knew his life was near its end. He also got sick, and he saw something in Uman that it was a special place to be buried and to spend his last days. And he passes away in Sukkot of 1810 in Uman. Okay. So I hope you will appreciate the traumatic life Rabbi Nachman of Breslov lived. Losing children, running from place to place, always getting persecuted by one Rebbe, by another Rebbe, again and again. Losing his wife, losing his children, his house burns down. He lives only till 38 years old. And in those 38 years, he goes through so much suffering. And what's absolutely remarkable about Rabbi Nachman is that despite all that, his philosophy is remarkably positive and remarkably encouraging. Remarkably encouraging. In fact, one of the most essential teachings of Breslov is that no matter what happens, a person should never, ever give up hope, what we call yayish. And for Rabbi Nachman to say that, I hope you realize is incredibly meaningful. So at this point, I'd like to share a few brief teachings with you from Rabbi Nachman. And let me return to my title of this year. I entitled this year Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, the deepest and most simplest of Jews. Why is that? Rabbi Nachman's teachings are incredibly diverse. That is to say, some of his teachings are very basic, practical advice anyone can follow. And I'm hoping that as we read some of this together, maybe some of you can take some of this with you in your own life and implement it. It's doable today. So some of what he says is very basic and practical. And then some of what he says is so deep, laced with Kabbalah, full of quotes from the Zohar and other Kabbalistic texts. It's full of it. And Rabbi Nachman quotes from everywhere, from the Gemara and the Medrash and the Zohar and the Chumash and the Tanakh. And so it's just a mix of the most profound and the most simple. And that on top of the fact that Rabbi Nachman emphasized simplicity. Rabbi Nachman lived during the Enlightenment, in which many Jews who were very philosophically inclined began to leave traditional Judaism. And Rabbi Nachman's reaction to that was to discourage on some level complexity. To say that ultimately a person does not need to get so caught up in philosophical speculation, but rather we should have a simple faith and devotion to God. And yet, so much of Rabbi Nachman's Torah is so complex, because let's be honest, it's complex to be a simple Jew. Being a simple Jew isn't so simple. Being a simple servant of God isn't so simple. Especially if you have a difficult life. So there's a paradox there between simplicity and incredible depth. And that's what I'd hopefully like to share with you together. Let's begin with this piece in source number two. And in source number two here, Rabbi Nachman talks about something we call his bodedut, His Bodhidus. Has anyone heard of his Bodhidus? Hit Bodhidus? Raise your hand if you have. Anyone heard of this notion? Hit Bodhidus means isolation. Praying in isolation. Rabbi Nachman and Breslovers to this day, and many people do this. And I find this to be so in tune with modern psychology and what we know about mindfulness and its positive impact on our mental and physical health. I mean, Nachman encouraged something called Kedvodadut, and here he describes it. I'm going to read, for time's sake, and I know because it's late, I'm going to read from the English translation. I got that from Safaria. And Safaria took it from the Breslov Institute, so it's not perfect. Feel free to read along in the Hebrew, but hopefully we can gain something from this together. Here it goes. Hitbodadut, which means isolation, is the highest asset and greater than everything. What does it mean? What do we mean isolation? That is, to set aside for oneself at least an hour or more for secluding oneself in some room or a field. And using, I don't like this translation already, lafarei shichato, which means to explicate one's speech with one's maker, to talk to God, using words that evoke favor, placate, and conciliate in order to entreat and plead with God that he bring one closer to him, to genuine divine worship. Hitbodadut means, and an hour seems like a lot. That seems like a lot of time. So maybe if we're going to do this, we could start with 5 minutes. But Hitbodadut means to isolate, to be alone, and to be fully present with God, and to talk to him. And to talk to him about what's on one's mind and on one's heart, and to express to God that despite one's difficulties and challenges, I want to get close to you. Just to talk like that. And look what he says here. And while this may not seem as controversial nowadays, imagine this 200 years ago, in a time where everything was about tradition. He says, this prayer and conversation should be in the language one normally uses, one's native tongue, because it is difficult for a person to say everything he wants to say in the holy tongue, the Lashon HaKodesh. Also, being unfamiliar with that language, one heart is not moved by the words, as we are not accustomed to speaking Hebrew. Did you hear what he just said? How many of you sometimes struggle with prayer? How often do we talk about how prayer is so difficult? How it's difficult because we say the same thing every day and because we don't know Hebrew so well and the language is a barrier. Rabbi Nachman says over 200 years ago, you know what? So don't pray in Hebrew. Don't pray in Hebrew. Take time for yourself just to speak in your native tongue. You might not be so familiar with Hebrew. So don't speak in English or Yiddish or whatever you speak. But in our native tongue in which we normally speak and converse, it is much easier and so more likely for one to feel contrition. One to feel that feeling of, oh, Hashem, I just want to get close to you. I feel bad about some of the things I've done. To really feel it. This is because the heart is drawn to a person's native tongue and closer to it on account of his familiarity with it. A very basic observation and recommendation, but one that is very actionable and can have a profound impact. Speak to God in your native tongue. And he continues. And in one's native tongue, one can express oneself fully. What do you think he means by express oneself fully?
Whatever's in your heart.
Right. Do you ever feel encumbered by davening? Do you ever open up a sitter and say, you know what? I'm not really in the mood to talk about Al HaTzadikim right now, or Hashiva Shoftenik Varishana, to talk about the judges. that there's so many other things on my mind. And we could try, and by the way, this is not taking away from saying the traditional prayers. Rabbi Nachman's not advocating. He's going to be very clear that we should still recite the traditional prayers. But there's so much that those don't really cover. And you might have something on your mind, whether it's something that's bothering you or that you're struggling with or that you're thankful for, that you find difficulty expressing in the text of our tefillot. And Rabbi Nachman saying, so take time with God to be fully present and to express yourself fully. And he says everything that in his heart he should express and tell to God, be it remorse and repentance for the past or pleas to genuinely merit drawing closer to God from this day forward or the like, each individual according to his level, whatever is on your mind. And he says one should be very careful to make this a daily practice at a scheduled time. But the rest of the day, one should be happy, as mentioned above. It's interesting, isn't it? Make this a part of your schedule to be fully present in this sort of prayer to God, but also be happy. Why mention also be happy? You know what Nachman doesn't want you to do? What does constantly doing this run the risk of doing? Causing a certain melancholy, sadness. It's like, oh, Hashem, I feel bad about this, I feel bad about that, and I want to get close to you, and I'm struggling with this, I'm struggling with that. The person emphasizes that too much, they're going to walk around, and they're going to look like, you know, they're living the worst life in the world. But Nachman doesn't want that. So some time in the day is for this very present expression to God, unencumbered by any specific text or language. But the rest of the day, try to be happy. And I think they build on one another, don't they? Because what takes away from our happiness so often? What takes away? What stops us from being happy? Usually, it's that baggage. It's those thoughts, those negative thoughts that are on your mind. And they're just sitting there. And sitting there and sitting there and sitting there. And so it's very difficult to be happy when that happens. And so Rabbi Nachman says, if you take this hour to fully express yourself to God, then hopefully you'll unload that baggage. And then you will be happy the rest of the day. Again, a very basic, but also very, I find, impactful insight. And what if we actually did this? Not for an hour. You know what? I have a feeling not too many of us are now going to walk out this year and take an hour. Maybe take 5 minutes. Try it. Rabbi, that's so heebie-jeebie. I don't talk to God like that. Really? Don't we daven 3 times a day? Isn't that supposed to be talking to God? Just take 5 minutes, a minute, 1 minute, and talk to him about whatever is on your mind. Whatever it is. The benefit of this practice, says Rabbi Nachman, is extraordinarily great. It is an extremely good path and guideline for drawing closer to God because it's a universal guideline that encompasses everything. Everything. What is the most fundamental goal of religion? Is it not to have a real relationship with God that you feel like you're open with him and connected to him? Does that not encompass everything? Isn't everything predicated upon that? That's what Rabbi Nachman's encouraging us to do. And here he ends this piece as follows. This is again from Likutei Moharan, all available in English. The second version of Likutei Moharan, Essay 25. No matter what a person is lacking in worshiping God, even if he's totally and absolutely distant from God's service, he should speak about it all and ask of it of God, as mentioned above. And that's also the advantage of this, right? Because if a person has this open relationship, then they could have done the worst thing. But they could still talk about it. Because they talk about everything with God. You know, to walk into a shul, to walk into a Beit Midrash, to walk in, that's hard for us to do sometimes. Maybe you're not in the mood to do that. It's too hard for you. It's intimidating, but this doesn't require any of that. Now, I didn't actually quote it here, but Rabbi Nachman, I want to point out, please don't get me, don't misunderstand. Rabbi Nachman also says it's important to still do the prayers that are traditional. And we could think about why that is. But so many of those things which limit our prayer, Rabbi Nachman is telling us, we can avoid if we also couple that traditional prayer with Hitbod Adut. And it has to be when you're alone. Because you're not going to be fully open if someone else is there. Oh, someone else is watching. We act so much differently when we're being watched. We act so much differently when we know someone else is listening. I don't know if I can talk about this. I can't talk about that. So it has to be time alone with God. But it could be so powerful. And I think even beyond the religious aspect, it could be so healthy psychologically. Moving on a little bit. Let's move a little quicker over here. As I mentioned before, one of the big themes in Breslov is never to, what we say, be miyayish, yeush. Yeush means something deeper than being sad or down. Yeush means it's over. It's it. I lost. I'm done. Maybe you've bordered on that sometimes. You know, you just feel like whether it's a relationship, maybe it's a task you've always wanted to accomplish that just seems beyond your grasp, and you try again, you just can't do it. Maybe it's a struggle that you have, a challenge that you have, and you just keep on failing, and you can't seem to get it right. And again, Rabbi Nachman, who lost everything, went through every possible difficult experience in life you can imagine, tells us, never give up. Says Rabbi Nachman here. This is in Sichot Aran 3. Sichot Aran is not usually as complex. It's speeches that he gave that were written up by Rabbi Nachman. He writes, this is in Sichot Aran 3. You may fall to the lowest depths, heaven forbid, but no matter how far you have fallen, it is still forbidding to give up hope. You can't give up. You're not allowed to. Repentance is higher even than the Torah. Therefore, there is absolutely no place for despair. You could always do tshuva. If you are worthy, even your worst sins can be turned into something good. We are taught that sin can be transformed into merit. This idea contains deep mysteries. What do you mean sin can be turned into merit? Why? So, you know this Gemara we learn about every Yom Kippur, that a person does tshuva me'ahava, repents out of love. Zidonot na sin lo kizchuyot, his purposeful sins become merits. Why? Rabbi Nachman says, it's a deep secret. But you know what? Doesn't really matter. Let me tell you the basic understanding of it. Because Rabbi Nachman does so often, and this is written in his introduction to Likutei Moharan, that all of this is really, really deep if you truly understood the depth of the matter. But Rabbi Nachman says it in a way that even a simple person without the background of Hasidus or Kabbalah can understand. And the basic idea is, the main lesson is that even from one's failings and declines, one can easily return to God. We learn from our mistakes, and from those mistakes, we can return. They can inspire us to return, and so they become merits. Nothing is beyond his power. The most important thing is to never give up, but to continue to cry out and pray to God. Again, very basic, a very basic teaching. But Rabbi Nachman is saying, not just don't give up, not just never give up. It's forbidding. You're not allowed to. You never, the Torah says it is forbidden to give up. And he actually opens up the piece. If God is all encompassing, if God is all powerful, if God is omnipotent, so should there be a limit to what you can return from? Should there be a limit to tshuva? Of course not. There is no limit. So never give up. Okay. The next piece is a bit more of a parable. And I found this parable very insightful as well. I hope that you will too. And Rabbi Nachman, again, we're not going to learn of his stories, but you can read about them. Maybe I'll share one of his stories at the end. Maybe we'll end with that. But Rabbi Nachman has all sorts of stories that he wrote, and they're filled with tales of princes and kings and queens and quests and treasures. and they're filled with all sorts of fairy tales, and they're actually very enticing. But there's a depth in terms of the nimshal, the parable. They're all hints or allegorized, very deep ideas in Torah. Rabbi Nachman said, listen, if you're not going to listen to my Torah, you'll at least listen to my stories. So listen to this parable here. A parable about the Yetzer Hara. He writes, the evil inclination is like a prankster running through a crowd, showing his tightly closed hand. Okay? So picture someone who's running around like this with a fist, showing everybody his tightly clenched fist. No one knows what he's holding. He goes up to each one and asks, what do you suppose I have in my hand? What's in the guy's hand? Each one imagines that the closed hand contains just what he desires most. Are you looking at the person with his hand? Oh, what's he have in his hand? It must be so incredible. It must be that one thing that I really, really want. They all hurry and run after the prankster. What's he got in his hand? Then, when he has tricked them all into following him, he opens in his hand, and guess what? It's completely empty. The hand is completely empty. The same is true of the evil inclination. He fools the world, tricking it into following him. All men think that his hand contains the desire. Yetzer Hara is always telling you, what you really, really, really want, he's got it. Gotta try it, he's got it. In the end, he opens his hand. There's nothing in it, and no desire is ever fulfilled. It's empty. It's empty. And so you want more and more and more. Worldly pleasures are like sunbeams in a dark room. They may actually seem solid, but he who tries to grasp a sunbeam finds nothing in his hand, right? You've ever been in one of these light shows, and maybe you've seen little children, and they run after the beams of light, and they try to grab it. It's shiny. It's attractive. But what is the beam of light? Nothing. Can't grab a beam of light. He who tries to grasp the sunbeam finds nothing in his hand. The same is true of all worldly desires. Okay, so again, a little bit more profound here. Thinking about the Yetzer Hara as that person running around with that clenched fist, and everybody wants to see what's inside, and it's nothing. Nothing's inside. Emptiness. Nothing meaningful. Hopefully that's a parable image, a powerful image we can take with us. When we are enticed, when we do feel that attraction, that magnetic pull of the Yetzer Hara, remember, it's that man with the empty clenched fist. And the last teaching I have on the source sheet, maybe I'll share a story that I find very meaningful for me, not with you, is this piece here in Likutei Moharan. This is profound. This is very deep. This here Rabbi Nachman talks about the greatest secret, the purpose of creation itself. Let's read about it together. And this will require you to think for a while. But I think the deepest ideas are those ones, and Rabbi Nachman says this too, the deepest ideas are those ideas that we don't fully grasp right away, that sort of linger on the top of our consciousness for a while until we finally feel like we got it. So here we go. God created the world as a consequence of his compassion. For he wanted to reveal his compassion. If creation had not taken place, to whom would he have shown his compassion? God, the reason for the world is because this is an idea also mentioned by the Ramchal. Hashem wanted to be mitiv, to give, to show his compassion. And in order for there to be a display of compassion, there needs to be a recipient of that compassion. For this God created the world. He therefore created the entire creation. from the inception of Atzilut. Atzilut is one of the Sfirot, which means the level of creation immediately beyond God himself, all the way down to the center point of the corporeal world in order to display his compassion. Okay. But how did that happen? And this is an idea we've talked about, but Rabbi Nachman, I think, gives a certain framing of this idea. Yet when God wanted to create the world, there was no place in which to create it. There was nothing but Ein Sof, the infinite one. God is all-encompassing. He's infinite. So he just encompasses everything. He takes up everything. There was no space for anything else. He therefore contracted the light to the side. And through this contraction, this simsum, the vacated space was made. What Rabbi Nachman calls hachalal hapanur. God creates a vacated space so that there can be a world. Then within this vacated space, all time and space came into existence, this being the creation of the world. So that's how God creates the world. He vacates, so to speak. He removes himself. The physical metaphor of light, which totally occupies a room, and God takes the light and moves some of it to the side so that there can be a chalal panoi, a vacated space. This vacated space was necessary for the creation of the world. Since without the vacated space, there would have been no place in which to create the world, as explained above. Yet understanding and comprehending this contraction, to truly understand what actually happened of the vacated space, will be possible only in the future, only la'atid lavo, since it is necessary to say about it two contradictory things, existence and non-existence. It's a paradox. In order to create the world, which Rabbi Nachman is going to say, can't exist without God, in order to create a space for the world, God had to create a vacuum, which is a lack of existence. So to create, for the world to exist, there had to be a non-existence. That doesn't really make sense. It's not something we can fully understand. And he says, this vacated space is a result of the contraction, that God, so to speak, withdrew his godliness from that place. Thus, there is, so to speak, no godliness there. There's a place with no godliness. Were it not so, it would not be vacated. There would then be nothing, but Ein Sof, with no place whatsoever for the world's creation. However, the actual truth is that even so, there is surely godliness there as well. Even in the vacated space, where God contracted, where Hashem removed himself, so that there could be a physical world, really? It's not so that it's devoid of God's presence. On a deeper level, even in the vacated space, God occupies that as well. Which Rav Nachman says is a paradox that we'll never truly understand. This is why it's not at all possible to comprehend the concept of the vacated space until the future. Rabbi Nachman is telling us our very existence is a paradox. A paradox in that God needed to remove himself from the world so that there could be a world, but the world could only exist because God is there, willing it to continue existing. In the next piece that I didn't put on the search, Rabbi Nachman says somehow this relates to the paradox between divine foreknowledge and free will. Right? Famous paradox. On the one hand, God sees all and knows all. On the other hand, the way we experience the world and the whole entire system of Torah and Halacha is predicated upon the notion that we decide what to do with our futures. How can both exist? Well, it relates to this paradox. It relates to this paradox of the world being a place where God vacated, but at the same time is constantly sustaining. And this notion of symptom, which again, this paradox, is profound because it means that we can conceive of something without God, but even that isn't possible. The problem of evil. The problem of evil. How could there be evil in the world with God? Well, God vacated from this space to allow for such a thing to happen. But on a deeper level, there is no place without God. So on the deepest level, even what we perceive as evil isn't actually evil. When you contemplate this paradox, its depth is really incredibly enlightening. So I hope you now see the breadth of Rabbi Nachman's Torah. From the deepest ideas, the most profound, really weighty, weighty notions, to the most simple, the most basic of never give up. Always maintain your hope. Be open and present with God. So I'll leave you with the story, Rabbi Nachman's story. Maybe you've heard this one, maybe you haven't. But I find it, again, to be very inspiring. The story goes like this. There was a king and his son, and they were in a palace. And suddenly they realized that everybody around them began to go insane. Absolutely crazy. They had all lost their minds. And the king's son realized that what was causing them to be crazy was the wheat. The wheat, the grain that they were eating. And so they didn't know what to do. Because on the one hand, they couldn't stop eating the grain. But on the other hand, if they would, they would go crazy. They would go insane. What should they do? So the king came up with the following solution to his son. The king says, listen, on the one hand, I don't want to go crazy. On the other hand, we have no choice but to eat this wheat. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to make each other a hat. We're going to make for each other a hat. And we're going to put on the hat. And we're reminding each other that when you look at this hat, you're going to remind yourself that you're crazy. And when I see you wearing the hat, I will remember that you're crazy. And when you see me wearing the hat, I will remember, you will remember that I'm crazy. And so at least if we're going to be crazy, if we're going to be in a world of insanity and foolishness, let us remember that we indeed are part of that foolishness. Let us at least know that we're insane. That's the parable. What is the nimshal? What is the meaning of the story? That's for us to think about. I think at a basic level, it's the notion that we live in this world. Listen, we live in a physical world. In this physical world, we have to participate in the physicality and the selfishness and all the things that life in this world requires. And so we put on certain things, maybe a yarmulke, some tefillin, to remind ourselves that while we are in this world participating in all the craziness, let us at least remember what's truly important. Let us at least remember what's truly meaningful. Even if we're going to have to do all that other stuff that everybody else is doing, let us at least remember that while we're doing it, it's not meaningful. It's emptiness. Okay. Anyways, I hope this at least exposed you to Rabbi Nachman's Torah. There's so much there. I'm no expert. I'm hoping next week, please God, I will let you know. We'll be able to hear from a true blessed Lever Chassid, an expert in Rabbi Nachman's Torah. But at the very least, there's so much to learn there. But the notion of being open with God and having a real, sincere, emotional, open relationship and being fully present, I think is such a powerful one, an important one for our day and age. And my blessing to you is that you all have that. That you all have that openness and that real, true emotional connection. And that by doing so, by getting rid of that baggage and having that hopefulness that God is always there and you can always return, that you live a life of happiness, a life full of simcha. Because that's what Rabbi Nachman truly wants from us. Thank you very much for listening. I apologize for being late. Have a wonderful night.